Welcome to Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Lauren Gawne.
And I'm Gretchen McCulloch. And in this 35th Patreon bonus episode, we get enthusiastic about the future of English. But first, we have a new goal for Patreon, and it's a very unglamorous goal that we are actually very excited about, which is to hire someone to help us with some of the admin for the show, for running the merch and the Patreon and all of the social medias and things like that.
This is going to be a goal that directly affects you as our patrons the most, because freeing us up from running the admin side of things means that we'll have more time to bring back the polls and to just hang out on the Patreon. So we're super excited about this goal. We hope that you're super excited about this goal. And we're really looking forward to more silly linguistic poll shenanigans.
Yeah, remember when we used to do polls asking you about whether you thought something was a sandwich or, you know, what kinds of new merch you'd be excited about? Those were fun. We liked doing them, but they took some time. And especially with Lauren going back to work, we are looking to regain some of that time. We're really excited to be bringing Claire on, who you might recognize as the person that we thank at the end of every episode for doing our audio editing, and also as the person who did an interview with me for a previous bonus episode about adjusting your language to other people.
We actually met this goal before we even got around to recording this episode, which is super exciting because it means it's all happening and you'll see Claire popping up to help with the admin side of things, and you'll hopefully be seeing us hanging around with more polls this year.
I am also personally really excited to get the tagging system for the bonus episodes a little bit more organized, because it's been bothering me that they're inconsistently tagged, and that is something that I would like some help with.
We're enthusiastic about linguistics, but we're also very enthusiastic about a good metadata structure.
Ontologies are really important, okay? I like a good ontology.
Gretchen, one of my favorite bits of the myriad of awesome publicity that you did for Because Internet was the New York Times opinion piece from the future, in which you went into a time machine and pretended to be writing an op-ed article in the New York Times from the future, but you wrote a real op-ed in the New York Times now, and it was all about what the future of English might look like.
It was a really fun piece to write, as if, you know, I was in the, like, 2020s rather than the 2200s. The future is hard. As if I was in the 2200s, the 23rd century. It was really fun to try to take that perspective of 200 years in the future and figure out what can we actually predict about the language? Because most of the op-eds in this Op-Eds from the Future series have been written like 10, 20, maybe 50 years in the future. But for language change, that's a pretty short timescale. So I wanted to say, what happens if we push it out so that we're looking back on the current era the way that current people might be looking back on, like, Jane Austen in the 1800s?
Which is a super fun thought experiment.
Yeah, you can still read Jane Austen. It's close enough that you can still understand it. So it wouldn't have to be, like, trying to write it in this very far future futurese. But there are some things that would be different about the way people wrote as well. And I was lucky enough to get to brainstorm this article with you and with another friend, A. Prevost, who's a speculative fiction writer, and to kind of come up with, okay, so what are some things that we might think of English happening if we're looking at it from 200 years in the future? What might have changed based on what we can see in English today?
We had so much fun with this that I think we came up with, like, about five times more ideas and hypotheticals and hypotheses than you actually needed for the article. And so we're going to take this opportunity to kind of talk about some of the things we think might happen with the future of English. Of course, you can never tell. And with all the usual caveats that, of course, there'd be other dialects and other things happening. So first of all, you have to think about what has changed that would also be across a large variety of standard Englishes, and would be the kind of thing you would write in the New York Times.
Right. So I came up with, between you and A.E. Prevost, like, I had quite a long list and didn't get to use them all. But it was also very interesting because I knew I was writing for a publication that now, and in the 1800s, was a very conservative publication. So in the future, they're probably also very conservative. So one thing that I did, for example, was I mentioned some internet acronyms, and I was like, yeah, did you know that LOL used to be an acronym, and it stood for laughing out loud? Like, isn't this interesting? Because I know that people now are really interested when you tell them that OK was actually once an acronym, and it stood for this sort of creative respelling of all correct as O-L-L-K-O-R-R-E-C-T. So I thought, you know, LOL is common enough that I think people are still going to be using it in 200 years, but I think they're going to have forgotten that it was an acronym.
Hmm.
But then the fun thing was, I also mentioned a few other acronyms, you know, OMG, WTF, like, do you know these were also acronyms? But I knew that the New York Times is very, very reluctant to print swear words. Like, they don't do this. They're posts on the blog Language Log, like, chronicling how reluctant they are to print swear words. And they are not going to make an exception for me. Like, if a public figure says a swear word, they will sometimes report on it. But even then, it's really hard. They're not going to make exception for this, like, random linguist who wants to write an op-ed. Like, I just knew that was not going to happen. So I decided that not just are they not going to make an exception for me in 2019, but they're also not going to make an exception for me in 2219, who writes this op-ed. You know, like, they're still not going to print the F word, even in the 2200s. Like, some things aren't going to change, because they're probably legitimately that conservative publication. And on the plus side, this meant that I didn't have to try to fight to get the F word in the New York Times.
So this future English is still very much, like, framed within the New York Times-ness of things.
Right, exactly. Like, this isn't, like, the future English of, like, how teenagers are texting with each other. This is a future English that's in a, you know, edited conservative publication, which actually makes it kind of easier, because the kind of English that shows up in edited prose is more conservative. So it doesn't have to have as many changes as presumably the you know, teens are doing or something. This was one that we didn't get to include because it just didn't quite fit in the article, but I had a lot of fun brainstorming with both you and A. Prevost. And this was one of the things that's really obvious about, you know, language change is that there's a new word for cool or a new word for drunk every, like, 5 to 10 years, sometimes even less.
Mm.
And a lot of these words, structurally, they're single syllables, and they often go consonant, vowel, consonant. So it'll be something like lit,
rad,
tight, smashed,
sweet.
Yeah, there's a whole set of them, and they don't necessarily all have initially positive meanings, like bad meaning cool or wicked meaning cool. You know, they don't necessarily initially have positive meanings. Or even something like lit, which, like, inherently doesn't have to have, you know, there isn't an obvious reason why that word in particular needs to cross over to be the cool trajectory, or why sweet needs to cross over to be the cool trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
But there seemed to be, like, a new one kind of comes up. And often gets appropriated from African-American English. Like, it doesn't just kind of come from nowhere, but it does enter a sort of mainstream vernacular. And didn't end up coming up in the article because I wanted the article to be more about the technological side. But we brainstormed this big list of other words that don't currently mean cool, but do have, you know, consonant, vowel, consonant, or consonant, vowel, two consonants, that, like, could become words for cool, maybe, in some future, because they have, like, a good sound to them.
Hmm, that's really hoot of you.
Exactly. So that's really hoot of me. I think another one was sop. Numb. That's really numb of you.
Mm.
That's really sop of you. I also thought maybe left. Like, that's really left of you. Because it's kind of like, it's got that sort of countercultural vibe that, like, bad as cool has.
Oh, yeah.
I'm left-handed, so I thought that was kind of cool. But then I was like, I don't know, maybe it's, like, left politically, so maybe that's going to be too complicated. or, like, sunk. That's really sunk of you.
Yeah, slang is just such a churn. Green's Dictionary of Slang is now publicly available, which I don't know if we've mentioned on the show and is really exciting. But, like, you know, things that just pop up and are caught in the record for, like, a moment, and you just look at it and you're like, that makes no sense to me, because it's in little hyper-local groups and it comes and goes. Like, cool is actually an anomaly for how long it has retained its meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, cool has stayed around for so long, but stuff like rad or dope or hype or what's the other one? Groovy. Like, groovy is now dated.
Groovy is very dated.
I get so excited about groovy because, like, at one point it was genuinely cool and it's just so not anymore.
Mm.
Oh, that's groovy, man. You know, so
you can't help but fall into stereotype right there.
Yeah, like, you have to sound like a California skater or something, surfer.
So that's some lexical, wordy choice stuff that you made, talking about LOL and, you know, thinking about cool.
I had a longer list. You know, some of them were mild. That's really mild, man. Rust. That's so rust. That's vast.
That's vast. I like vast. We have different vowels for it, but I'm down.
Yeah. The one that AE really liked was broke. Like, that's so broke, man.
Oh, yeah.
Which, that one kind of works, really.
It's not dissimilar semantically to British smashing. Like, that's smashing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's got that kind of, like, smashing, broke sort of sense. And it's got this nice, like, it's got some consonants around it, which seems to really help.
Yeah.
And, like, monosyllable, some consonants. But anyway, so if you have another monosyllable or a word in general that, like, doesn't currently mean cool, because we had to look these all up on Urban Dictionary to make sure no one was actually already using them to mean cool.
And we'll try and make fetch happen.
Yeah, we can make fetch happen. See? Like, fetch would work. It's got the right, like, consonant vowel consonant structure.
Yeah. It wasn't a complete dark horse candidate there.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have another word that does not currently mean cool, but maybe could mean cool in the future, I would love to hear just more candidates for words that could potentially become cool. We can start something in the comments.
So lol and words for cool, that's words. Obviously, word change is something that's very easy for us to keep track of, even as speakers. We know that groovy isn't cool anymore. We know that numb is not yet cool, but who knows? Maybe. But obviously, language change happens at all levels of language. So what other parts of language did you look at in the article?
Another thing that really interested me was the stuff that was happening, like, at the discourse level. Mm. So there are certain stock phrases that people use, often to do polite things.
Yeah.
And in English is currently undergoing a shift from "you're welcome" being the stock polite response to "thank you" to phrases like "no problem" and "no worries" being the stock polite responses to "thank you."
No worries is one of my defaults.
Yeah, it's very Australian. I think it's catching on more in North America now. Like, I definitely say it. I don't know if I would have done, you know, 20 years ago.
We're leading language change because we're technically in your future by, like, 10 hours.
Yeah, Lauren, from the perspective of Australia, how is the English of 10 hours in the future?
From the future, no worries is definitely catching on.
Great. Thank you for reporting back. But you get people these days complaining sometimes, like, oh, the kids don't say "you're welcome" anymore. And, like, honestly, like, these are just stock phrases. Like, previously people might have said "my pleasure" or "how do you do" instead of "how are you." Like, it's fine. It's just a stock phrase that you say to acknowledge something. So I thought, Wouldn't it be funny if "no problem" and "no worries" were the conservative thing that the grumpy old people were mad that no one was saying anymore? And there was a new one that the youths were saying that the grumpy old people didn't like.
I feel like I need to go back and reread this article with the circle of life playing in the background.
You know, it just keeps on cycling. It keeps on cycling. Yeah. So I was thinking about, okay, well, I don't want to do something else with "no X" because that's already part of this "no problem, no worries" template. But maybe something on the negative side. And then I was thinking about French and Spanish, which both have versions of "nothing." So in French you have "de rien," in Spanish you have "de nada," which both mean, like, "of nothing."
Yep.
And so I was thinking, how could you adapt this into English? And I think "of nothing" is not quite an idiomatic phrase in English.
No.
But you could say "it's nothing." And then those youths could adapt that into "snuffing."
I like it.
And this is at least kind of superficially plausible as, like, a strategy that a language could totally have, because we know that French and Spanish have a similar strategy. So, you know, maybe English has either been influenced by these languages or, you know, has just gone in that direction for other reasons. And maybe people are saying this. I don't actually think that people are necessarily going to be saying this particular one. It was definitely one that I made up for the article. But it was like, I think people will keep adapting different things to say in response to "thank you."
My informal option is definitely "it's all good." Which I will often reduce to "soul good." So you've got your ear to the ground on this one, I think.
Yeah, like that initial S, I think, is very reasonable. "Soul good." Yeah, maybe I could have put that in the article. Oh, well, I didn't.
That's okay. Because that's not the future. That's right now.
Well, it is the future because you're using it from Australia.
True. Yeah. Keep an eye out for it in 10 hours' time, Gretchen.
Okay, I'll... when I'm asleep, someone's gonna, like, a ghost is gonna waft into my bedroom and say, "it's all good."
It's all good, mate. So these little, like, "it's no worries," "you're welcome," they're kind of like little fossilized. That's why we talk about it as being a discourse thing, because they're not individual words, but these phrases get treated as little lumps of meaning. And not even really meaning, just lumps of function.
Yeah, they get used in particular contexts for their social function, not for the meaning of the individual words within them, because these two things, like you're welcome and no worries, which have no words in common with each other, are effectively synonyms, except for their pragmatic context.
The technical term for these is phatic, but I think I'm going to change the technical name to lumps of function.
I kind of like phatic. It sounds like to go back to those like cool words, like it's fat, P-H-A-T, it's so cool.
Yeah,
I can't say fat sincerely. Like, I'm not that cool.
No, there is no way that I ever was of the appropriate social group to use that unironically.
No, I was never the right generation for that. But yeah, phatic expressions of the pH are one of my favorite things that people don't necessarily know about linguistically. I actually did a video with Tom Scott about them, which we should link to.
Oh, yeah.
And speaking of the kinds of stuff that you do in discourse, another thing that I was really excited to do, especially from this perspective of this very, like, literary New York Timesian thing to write, was to allude to some of the potential effects on literature or formal styles of writing. Because if you think back to the 1800s, Jane Austen's era is at the beginning of the novel.
Hmm.
And they had to figure out a lot of the conventions that we now take for granted in a novel. So a lot of early novels are written as diaries, or they're written as series of letters, or they're written as memoirs, like fake memoirs, because people didn't have this sense yet that you could actually just, like, know things about fictional people omnisciently.
You could just write a story. We take it for granted now.
Yeah, like, you could just write a story. You could just be like, you know, and then Mr. Darcy saw Lizzie Bennet. Like, that's fine. Some omniscient, like, you know, godlike narrator could just narrate that. And it had to be like, you know, and then I saw this, and then I did this, and like now I'm old and I'm telling my memoir about this or something like this, because it needed this sort of framing, and then it gradually sort of stepped out of this framing as people got more used to it. So the idea that a novel could even exist was something that people were still working on, especially in English. I mean, the novel has older roots in Japan as well. But this idea of what we think of as a novel in English was something people were working on. And so I was thinking, okay, so what would be the equivalent of that? Like, what are the formats that maybe we're still working out in the 2000s that by the 2200s we would have figured out?
Well, like a compelling Insta story, which is a genre that I am completely incompetent at but really appreciate.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the ones that I thought of was, what about the thread?
Ah, yep.
So this idea of, like, you can have a Twitter thread, like, I'm going to do this thread, which has really just arisen in the past couple of years because Twitter didn't really support it very well, even just a few years ago. But I think people really like them. And I'd be surprised if we aren't still doing them in 10 years, and maybe we'll still be doing them in 200 years, but there'll be, like, more formats for them. Like, this idea that you can selectively engage with different parts of a message, like, you can choose to retweet one part of a thread and not others, or you can have this sort of linked thing that unfolds in real time as the person's kind of working out their thoughts.
I always love when someone has a really long thread, but there's just, like, the take-home message tweet is the one that goes viral.
Mm. And then you, like, you can have this additional context if you want it, but you don't have to, like, click through, because you can still get a pretty good message, even if you don't go.
Yeah.
And so I thought, what if my imaginary, like, future avatar of myself in 200 years has drafted this op-ed as a thread? Because that's how you do a draft, to, like, test out your sentences to make sure that they're all, like, pithy and vital and they can stand alone. Because you can't get away with as much, like, slack in a thread.
I feel like a Twitter thread has made me better at thinking about, like, essay structure.
Yeah, exactly. Like, sometimes I will draft something out as a thread and then be like, oh, wait, now I should turn this into a blog post. But it, like, a lot of the sentences from the thread are still really good and really, like, they really hit home because they all have to be able to stand alone.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, like, maybe this is what happens to literature. Or maybe there are textolatry novels, which is a word I made up, and microfiction. Because, like, you have epistolary novels now. Which is in letters. So what if you have novels that are told in text exchanges? And there are a few of these that exist at the moment. I think I made up the word for them. Maybe some of the people have also made it up independently. But maybe there is a larger genre of novels that exist as text exchanges, the way it doesn't seem weird these days for something to exist as a series of letters or notes.
I look forward to that genre emerging, hopefully in the real future as well as the hypothetical one.
I mean, I would read this. Yeah, I'd be interested in it.
To zoom all the way, you know, we have this big picture discourse, how paragraphs go together, to zoom right in to the nitty-gritty of punctuation, because I feel like we have to mention way you see the future of emoji, because you spend so much time talking to people about what emoji are doing now. It must have been very exciting to imagine what could happen in the future with how they integrate into language.
Yeah. So this was inspired by a couple different conversations that I've had with various people about emoji, what I did with them. And one of them was some of the work by Janelle Shane, who's done, and there's a, I think there's a project, I think it's out of Google, that like people draw stuff and the neural network like tries to tell you what you've drawn, or people put in a word and the neural network like tries to draw it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And Janelle did some stuff like playing with this data set. And so I thought, these drawings right now are really bad. But in 200 years, a lot can happen. Maybe these drawings can be really good. And one of the big problems that's kind of emerging in emoji is that we keep adding more emoji, which is very nice, but it gets harder and harder to find emoji because there's more and more of them.
Yeah.
So what if in 200 years, we mostly abandon this idea that we're going to have like preset emoji and you need to go find them? And instead, we, you know, use AI augmented drawing where you kind of like do a bad sketch and the computer makes it into something better. And that's what, like, you send to people.
Most phone keyboards now have a way of searching for emoji where you do a really bad drawing of them and it will bring up the emoji. And sometimes I don't need to use emoji. I just kind of enjoy drawing and seeing if the computer can guess right. So we're already vaguely moving in that direction.
Yeah, we're kind of vaguely moving in that direction. And the fun thing about saying, well, what if we have AI augmented drawing and like it gets really good, is that you can imagine the same sorts of moral panics that you have now about writing, but applied to drawing. Like, kids aren't going to be creative anymore because the machine helps you draw. Or like, they don't get practice, or like, they don't do any of the sorts of things like, you know, no one's going to want to take an art class because you can just do AI augmented drawing instead or something like this.
I can see that being a moral panic. I mean, you can make a moral panic over anything, but that one sounds very plausible to me.
Right, like this sounds very plausible. And so you can say, look, well, from the perspective of 200 years in the future, we know that emoji didn't kill writing. And so therefore, we know that these new AI augmented drawings, which I called emotions just because it's another word that sounds like emoji, we know that they aren't going to kill art either. And you have this sort of moral panic around like the camera is going to kill art, or like the photocopier is going to kill art because it's so easy to reproduce things now and they don't kill art. So like, I don't think if we manage to get AI augmented drawing that it will kill art either. But it's a moral panic you can imagine people having, and it kind of sheds light on the moral panics of today, which I also don't think are legitimate.
That is definitely a subtext across the whole article that I very much appreciated. And if you've read a lot of the like moral panic about kids ruining language type genre, your future linguist sounds not entirely dissimilar to contemporary linguists.
Yeah, and you can, like, contemporary linguists do sometimes write this op-ed of like, you know, kids these days are fine, they're not ruining language. And so in some senses I was trying to like do that genre but have all the data be made up and all the examples be made up.
So I guess the most important question is, did you have fun doing this?
I had so much fun doing this, and I think one of the most fun things was that, so there's a Twitter account that tracks words that appear for the first time in the New York Times.
Hmm.
Because there's a whole corpus of all of the New York Times back to previous centuries, and you can find out, like, here's a word that no one has previously gotten on the pages of the Times.
Okay, and given that you're writing from the future and using words that I know are definitely made up, like emosh, you must have had a few of those.
I did. I got 5, and I was very, very pleased with myself. And it was very funny because I think I had more people on Twitter being like, oh my god, I'm so impressed you got words in the new New York Times, than that I actually got, like, existing words in the actual New York Times. So like, no, but you got 5 words in the new one. I was like, this is great. My friends have really good priorities.
Yeah.
So the 5 words that I got in the new New York Times Twitter account were snuffing, mm-hmm. which we already mentioned, and textolatry.
Yep.
Which you already mentioned. And then a couple that came from my decisions about punctuation. Because one of the other really subtle things that I wanted to do was I wanted to punctuate this according to where I thought the New York Times style guide would have ended up in 200 years. And one of the things that we know about punctuation that's just incredibly predictable is that words that start out as kind of self-conscious compounds, and they have a space in between them or they have a hyphen in between them, as they get more common, people gradually join them up and delete that space or that hyphen. And so I figured, okay, well, any word that I'm putting in this article that is a current compound now, in the 21st century, it's going to get its hyphen or its space deleted for this 200 years later thing. And if a word is a new compound that I make up for the purpose of the article, then it can keep its hyphen.
Right.
That was how I did it. And so that meant that I got doom-mongering, like all one word, and all lowercase as all one word, both in the New York Times, because, of course, currently you would write those with a hyphen. And this was like spotting the versions that didn't have the hyphen.
Subtle, but it kind of drives home just how much he thought about putting this article together.
Yeah, and I had to make a case to the copy editor, be like, hey, here's this interesting thing I want to do. Like, is this going to be okay? Because, like, maybe they want to copy edit it to their standards. And they were like, oh, no, this sounds really fun. Let's do this.
Of course, a copy editor would say, it sounds really fun to think about hyphens.
I think it's really fun. And then the fifth word that I got in was an old school acronym that I actually dug out from like 20 years ago that isn't even current anymore, because I wanted to put like some slang that was already dated in there to kind of create that more dated effect. And that was HHOJ, which stands for haha, only joking, except no one uses it anymore.
Gosh, no, no one uses that anymore.
It's pretty obscure.
Of course, you are not the first person to think about the future of English. People do this kind of thought experiment when they write sci-fi set in an English-speaking future. Often it's a lot of, like, words. People's word choices indicate that it's a future English. Sometimes people go into a bit more detail on that. So one of the more elaborate versions of this I can think of is David J. Peterson's Tregetta slang for the grounder people in The 100, which is set on the premise of, like, what happens if we left a little community of people alone in the forests of Earth while we went up into space for a century or two and came back?
Yeah, so you have some stuff you can kind of recognize as related to English, but it also it picks up a lot of stuff from modern English slang, because you don't have as many like institutions of prestige trying to, you know, hold on to those conservative bits of language.
Yeah, whereas you were trying to do a future English that was a very, you know, staying close to what we think of as standard English now. This was a case of, like, what happens to future English if you just focus on one community of people talking a specific dialect? And so it's a lot more different to what we can understand.
Yeah, and so something like Tregetta slang, it translates to forest language, and you can hear that slang at the end, which either must come from slang or from lang, as in language. So that's kind of deliberately being that sort of casual thing of clipping words and mushing them together and stuff like that. Whereas this was saying, okay, how formal can you get and still have some changes in there?
And of course, future Englishes are always predicated on the English that we have now. So yours, obviously, you wanted to think about emoji, you know, Clockwork Orange. It's no surprise that a book written a few decades ago saw English as interacting a lot with Slavic languages because it was the height of the Cold War, whereas something like the Belta Creole from The Expanse brings in influences from Germanic languages and Mandarin and Slavic languages. So it has a lot more kind of diversity, kind of reflecting a more globalized world.
One future English version that I really enjoy that people may not have heard of as much is there's a page called FutureEase, which was created in 2003 by a conlanger, and it maps out language changes for several different periods from the year 2100 to the year 2400 to the year 2700 to the year 3000.
So it tracks the language change. That's nifty.
So in the American South, these days, you have a certain amount of pronunciation of certain vowels like fight as fat or right as rat, where this thing that is an I sound becomes an ah. So this futurese, which explicitly represents itself as like future American, takes this types of like vowel changes as a starting point for how could sounds continue to change. Maybe more vowels go through processes like this.
Yeah.
And other stuff like that. So it's a really interesting page to read, and we'll link to it. It's very long and complicated.
Oh, those tricky, shifty vowels. You're lucky that you got to do something in writing, Gretchen, and you could just say that writing had stayed the same regardless of pronunciation.
Right, exactly. That's the thing. It's like writing from Jane Austen's period is really very similar. Like, we still have all these silent letters. Like, she had a bunch of silent letters. We have a bunch of silent letters. A few things have changed, but like, it's pretty similar. So keeping it in a more formal genre actually made my job like way easier than actually having to be a proper conlanger.
Oh. For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I tweet and blog as Superlinguo.
I can be found as @GretchenAMixie on Twitter. My blog is allthingslinguistic.com, and my book is Because Internet. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gaughan. Our audio producer is Claire Gaughan, our managing editor is Emily Graff, and our production editor is Sarah Duffy-Ralla. My music is Ancient City by The Triangles.
Thank you so much for being a patron.
Stay Lingthusiastic!